This is Susan Schwartz, June 6, 1992. The Handless Maiden, Betrayal of and by the Father. Tape 4 of 4.
Yes.
It doesn't say exactly what type of book. I wonder if it's for the fish themselves, if it's sufficient. I haven't read this story before.
Well, I'll tell you what, keep it in your mind. And let's see if it ends up to be that way. It doesn't say, but you know, all right, but you know, here we come to the cultural part of the fairy tale. There used to be hooks that one did on shoes, and also on hooking the stays or the buttons or whatever. So in our modern times, we might not think about that first, but if we were reading this fairy tale 100 years ago, you know, it might have been really apparent. Nobody would have sat around and said, hook. Of course we know what a hook is, right? Can do that also. Absolutely. In fairy tales, you can do, it's like dreams, you could do a lot of things, right? Okay, let's have one more paragraph and then we take a break for a little bit.
4,000 birds, as they call them, lived for a long time, most miserably, in the beautiful king's daughter and knew not when it would end or how. It happened, however, after a time that a festival was to take place in the castle, which he said to the cook, "May I go out for a little while, to see the company arrive? I will stand outside to the door." "Yes, you may go," he replied, "but in half an hour I shall want you to sweep up the ashes and put the kitchen in order." Then she took her little oil lamp, went into the stable, threw off the fur coat, washed some mud stains from her face and hands, so that her full beauty appeared before the day. After this, she opened the nutshell and took out the dress that was golden as the sun and put it on. And as soon as she was quite dressed, she went out and presented herself at the entrance of the castle as a woman. No one recognized her at all first. They thought she was the king's daughter and sent and told the king of her arrival. He went to receive her, offered her his hand, and while they danced together, he thought in his heart, "My eyes have never seen any maiden before so beautiful as this."
Well, again, here we have a repeat in that how does the king get lured by the maiden but by her beauty? At least at the beginning, there is some redemption in the fact that it isn't just for her beauty that we might hope that she would be desired. Anybody have any ideas about this paragraph?
I got the sense that it was her intent to be accepted in a hand. Knowing her power, the beauty of that she had instigated this to occur, to obviously evolve out of her incubation.
Right, exactly. And it's done in stages. It isn't all at once that she's going to completely emerge. As well as there is a part here which says she lived for a long time most miserably. Once again, we have this space that I referred to last evening with von Franz, who says that you have to spend a lot of time alone, not necessarily miserably, but kind of wondering, will I get through this or not? Yes?
That's a very interesting reversal. Who went to receive the offer of her in hand?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, in other words, she's not under the power of the under the spell of the masculine, right? Because she can accept or no, and he acts very differently, showing how much the masculine has changed. A very different king we have here. Mm-hmm. Anybody else have any ideas else? There's another thing in here, too. and that she knows her sense of timing, doesn't she? There is a time when you've got to be aware, okay, it's time to jump out now. This is the occasion. This is when I should be revealed. This is when it's all right. But it's a knowing inside the timing. Now, did she get that? Maybe she always had it, or maybe there's something about working in the kitchen, a place of transformation and change, very low work from being this the king's daughter and living up quite high, really getting down into the stuff, the mixing of things, the, again, being in it enough, as well as having lots of days of being like an animal. Looking like an animal, having the skins on, very different kind of dress than what a king's daughter would really wear.
Putting the things in order.
Putting them in order. That's exactly right. Right. Right.
Yeah. It's important that I'm like Snow White, that, you know, instead of the casket being open at the end, and he's just going to be a white mistake, she opens the nutshell. She's the one who.
She opens herself, right? And so we come back to this whole idea of how does one gain a fathering for oneself. It has something to do with opening, doesn't it? And knowing timing and gaining a sense of relationship with oneself. She's done, but if she was really done, this would be the end of the fairy tale. Fairy tales have always got several done stages. And usually it's three dones. And then you're done. You know, it's Jung refers to the three, which then turns into four. So the four usually is the resolution of the fairy tale. But there's always, usually, three kind of times that you could say would be either tasks or things that you have to do or times in the fairy tale when, this is the end, and it's not. You had a comment.
I'm wondering if the staining that you put on, and I think it's interesting in the square because it was not consummated incest, but incestuous psyche, like intent, right? Was that she stains herself and that shame of feeling to be the object of the sexual object of the father. She puts that on, she takes the tradition of staying and hides underneath that shame and staying in the walnut. And when she chooses, when she's thought about or incubated it enough, she can launch that on, but she's not done with it quite.
Right.
This
right.
is a shame.
Right.
Question.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Yeah.
But somebody who has been in sense with the shame sticks to them in a different way, and I think it's more like the.
It doesn't.
Kind of flaying process of getting rid of that.
Yeah.
Shame.
Yeah, because there is something about the flaying there that's in taking off the stain.
And the skins.
And the skins also have to do with flaying, too. Which is part of the process, anyway, of psychological growth. There's a certain flaying that happens symbolically. The other thing that I wonder, and I don't know, what is the symbol of the walnut? Just of interest, we might say, okay, look it up in a symbol book and say, what does a walnut mean? That we don't know. But still, a walnut, the meat of it is inside the shell. Ah, all right. See, there we go. All kinds of different images that come out. Pardon me?
Brain
also. So at any rate, there's something inside of the shell which wants to emerge. It's a seed. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Bringing forth life.
Right.
Uh-huh. Ready to unfold. Mm-hmm. In a nutshell. Right. Exactly. Exactly. Okay, why don't we take a break? I don't know if you've read any of her things. It's Women in Nature. Women in Nature. It's a beautiful, but I think it fits with exactly where we're at in the fairy tale and also this woman who I referred to. We are in pain. The pain is excruciating. We cannot escape it. We cannot escape. It hounds us. It tells us we should not exist. It is everywhere. Our own voices screaming. We hear our own voices. There is nowhere we can hide. The pain is inescapable, telling us over and over of our murderous impulses, our appetite for death. This is really what we're talking about when in a situation like this, when the father figure is way too heavy, one cannot really live. And an incest situation really saps the life out of a person. Certainly it's obvious, but I think the extent of it is really said also quite nicely in this phrase from that Susan Griffin says, because truly it is incredible pain. Also, I must say again that I didn't bring and don't usually use people who are not in an incredible amount of pain just because, first of all, I think that's part of the whole process, as well as it makes it very clear. The extension situation really makes it clear as to what we have to deal with, that all of us have to, in some kind of a way, deal with the amount of pain that we hear. So, let's start. Incidentally, in the break, did anybody have any comments or things you might have brought up? You had some comments about some of the symbols. You want to just say what they...
Yes, where she's doing the hard work, drawing the water, stream of fire, pumping the cells, which is strictly drawing the water, the unconscious, pumping the cells, burying the animals, the instincts, looking after the vegetables. To me, that reminds me of the unconscious, not even knowing that you're doing anything else.
The basic stuff, right? Exactly. And also, I think what happens in the kitchen, the place of transformation. Any of these things, stirring fire, drawing water, plucking balls, are all transformative things. Looking after vegetables, yes.
The other thing that I thought of was when you're in that place, regularity and the mundaneness of daily tasks supports that kind of work. It gives a flow to an order to
the work.
Process.
Exactly. That's why the routine of one's life is incredibly important, because then you have a regularity that you can count on when there's so much upheaval in transformation, in change, in separating, in becoming yourself. So the routine is very, very important to have.
And also with the narcissism. The mother was incredibly narcissistic. You must have one in mind, perfect image. You know, and so for her not to be in the image with her mother, she has to break through the narcissistic tendencies in herself.
Right, yes.
And the hubris of being a princess.
Right.
She must become
yes.
And
yes. Get down to earth. Right. The other thing that she has to break is, of course, the projection of the father's anima onto her. So she's got to break both. The mother's, and that's true anyway in the process of breaking the mother's projection of how the daughter is supposed to be, as well as breaking the projection of how the father says the female is supposed to be. So it's a double kind of thing to do. Anybody else? Okay, why don't we begin again then?
As soon as the dance was over, she bowed to the king, and before he could look round, she had vanished. No one knew where. The sentinel at the castle gate was called and questioned, and he had not seen anyone pass. But she had run to the stable, quickly removed her dress, stained her face and hands, put on her fur coat, and was again bound to clothes. When she entered the kitchen and began to do her work and sweep up the ashes, the cook said, "Leave that alone till tomorrow, for one who cooks some soup for the king. I will also taste a little when it is ready. But do not let one of your hairs fall in, for you will get nothing to eat in future from me. Then the cook went out and found him for a made king's soup as nicely as she could, and cut bread for it. And when it was ready, she fetched from the little stable her gold ring and laid it in the dish in which the soup was prepared. After the king had left the ballroom, he called for the soup, and while eating it, thought he had never tasted better soup in his life. But when the dish was nearly empty, he saw to his surprise the gold ring lying at the bottom, and could not imagine how it came there. Then he ordered the cook to come to him, and he was in a terrible fright when he heard the order. You must certainly have let a hair fall into the soup. If you have, I shall thrash you, he said.
So why don't we stop here just to kind of comment. You see that it is not just for her beauty that she might get this king. It's really what she does. And I think there's a certain process of work or of doing that might have something to do with regaining the father inside or regaining a sense of oneself. So that really is what's happening, isn't it? I mean, she's, yes.
I don't know that that is what's happening. To me, what is happening now is in a different space, because of this period of space. Communication now takes place at a different level. It's assumed that the gold is ready and the cook holds has something to do with the hair. So, in a rational space, some kind of communication space.
Well, it's interesting that the cook is living on one level, and what the woman is doing, what Thousand Furs is doing, is on a different level, and they're really not in communication in a sense. It almost would be like consciously one acts dot 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 like this. And then on the underneath, the real story is evolving.
I don't understand anything.
Pardon me?
I don't understand anything here. The king orders the cook to come to him, and he cooking,
right?
Okay, so the cook was in a terrible fright when the cook heard the order. He was talking about a hair fall with his tooth if he went up there.
Why? Right.
I didn't expect that.
What's in?
It's anonymous giving her a test.
Yes, but you know, she's got to work out the male principle because of this situation with the father. So that's why the cook has to be a man, I think. She has to work under him. That's what she's doing, isn't she, in the kitchen?
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
And she chose to leave the dance with her father to go there.
With the king, not her father.
Oh, yes, and the father king.
Right, right. So she goes from one male to the other, right? Yeah. In other words, she's working with both of them on both levels, actually. Huh? Yeah. Well, she has, but you know, I had this idea that maybe it tasted differently because of the gold ring. In other words, she'd put her own ingredient. Absolutely. And it made it better. Right. I mean, the soup was probably okay, but when your own self is in it, it's far better than any other soup that there is. Do you make soup? You know that. You put your secret ingredient in, and it's marvelous. It doesn't have to be marvelous to anybody else, as long as it is to you. Right.
It's interesting that the thing that's feared is the hair, and the thing that's amazing is the hair, whereas the hair, at the beginning of the story, is the son has
the blonde hair. Mm-hmm.
Very valuable, sacred about the golden hair, but here it comes from the very pejorative.
Well, I didn't think it was pejorative so much as we do. That if a hair of her head fell into the soup, that the king might find out that there's a golden hair laying in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. But the cook doesn't know if they're consciously, but they know if they're unconsciously.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know, but it doesn't happen if the cook has
Right.
She's in her animal first, but she's in the kitchen. So
she's in the animal.
Why would be revulsion? You know, it's not nice to find a carrier.
And the soup. Right. The other thing is that her furs make her into a darker animal, I think, or the implication that she's a dark animal, which is very different than the golden-haired mother. So she's taken the opposite side. And the finding the hair in the soup would maybe blow her cover, wouldn't it? Too early.
The cook is the masculine cook is the animus of the mother, and she puts one of her hairs in. It's her own ideas, and her mother was supporting the incest between the father and the daughter, and so she puts that in. Okay, then it will in a way expose that aspect, and so she puts in no symbols of an exogamous embryo. She puts it in there.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than something that's expressive of the mother's opening wish that you will marry someone who looks like me, i.e. you will sets up the intention of the father and daughter.
Mm-hmm.
She has to put her own self, her own ideas into the soup,
not the mother, right. So the cook really might be, in a sense, a continuation of the mother's animus. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's in the kitchen.
Right. So then the question is, if the woman is under the father, there's always this kind of masculine part that one is working for. And that, of course, does not work well, because a woman really has to work for herself, and the masculine is then in addition on the side. Partner. Can't work for the masculine if you're female. It makes you completely turned around. You're not working for your real self. I mean, this whole controversy, you know, Jung refers to the animus as the anima as soul, and then is the animus also the soul? And then can a woman have a man's soul? Or does she have her own soul? Oh, we could go on and on about this. But basically, and I just bring it up again because of the interactions of the archetypes, but basically, how can a woman be working under the guise of the masculine? Yes? Yes. Right. That's right.
But I mean, really found already that she has established a line of communication.
Right.
And so then she took the R lamp and went to the stable and did that important transformation. And now she's in the next level, she's doing some magic in the spirit of the third level, and it's her organization.
Right.
She asked the cook if she could go. She didn't just sneak out. She got his permission, and he said, yes, you can go, but you need to come back in time to do this work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something, an element of his...
She's not under... Sure, she's still under him. And, you know, that process lasts a long time of her being under a him, because that's actually where she began. So it's as we were talking a bit in the break, how does this whole process, does it ever get worked completely out, or do we somehow carry that with us as we go along to always be reminding us to be working for ourselves, not always under the him, or not getting the, always having to have the permission of the him, if one is under that kind of heavy father complex? It is complex.
Would she be implied that she is also an animal?
Well, that's a question. What do you think? Is she the anima woman with this golden hair? That's a classic anima woman, isn't it? I mean, I think Marilyn Monroe ran into quite a problem with it, didn't she? Psychologically and within her own personality, just as an example. Is she the anima woman? I'm not sure, because she doesn't really go along. She's got her own way. She put the stuff of herself in the soup. She did ask.
She has to be under the rule of the masculine.
She does, but she's moving out of it.
Right. She's also under the influence of the absolute mother. The first, after he tells her how to make the soup, then the cook went out. Mm-hmm. Just as the mother gets the promise from the father that you're not.
And goes out.
So she goes out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense plants the idea that she could do something like that.
Right. Right.
She plans, don't do it, and the hypnotic command is
do it.
Do it.
Right.
The paradox
statement. Exactly. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. There is, she's also dealing, just as much as people deal with the absent father, she's dealing with mothering herself in the absence of the mother, but with a lot of leftover stuff.
Sure. I think also this kind of absent mother is why she's got to have these furs on so much. She really has to be in it and involved in it. You can also see how the fairy tale really takes us all over the place and so many different psychological problems or stages of development and leaves so much openness for this. If you notice again, there really aren't, I mean, Thousand Furs is not really a name of a person. Nobody's really got a personal name. So it lets open for all kinds of personal things that we can put into it and all kinds of archetypal things that we can glean from it. So it's kind of a nice way to look at that development. Anybody else have? Okay, let's go on to the next, huh? Right.
As soon as he appeared, the king said, "Who cooked the soup? I cooked it," he replied. "That is not true," said the king. "This soup is made quite differently, and much better than you ever made." Then the cook was obliged to confess that Thousand Furs had made the soup. "Go and send her to me," said the king. As soon as she appeared, the king said to her, "Who are you, maiden?" She replied, "I am a poor child, without father or mother." He again asked, "Why are you in my castle?" "Because I am trying to earn my bread by helping the cook," she replied. "How came this ring in my soup?" he said again. "I know nothing about the ring," she replied. When the king found he could learn nothing from a Thousand Furs, he sent her away. A little time after this, there was another festival, and Thousand Furs again asked permission from the cook to go see the visitors. "But," he said, "come back in half an hour and cook for the king the soup that he is so fond of." She promised to return and ran quickly into her little stable, washed off the stains and took out of the nutshell her dress, silvery as the moon, and put it on. Then she appeared at the castle like the king's daughter, and the king came to receive her with great pleasure. He was so glad to see her again, and while dancing continued, the king kept her as his partner. When the ball ended, she disappeared so quickly that the king could not imagine what had become of her. But she had rushed down to her stable, made herself again the rough little creature that was called Thousand Furs, and went into the kitchen to cook the soup.
So we might say again that here with her kind of transferring from the rough little creature into the beautiful princess, she's able to hold both opposites, the rough creature but also the beautiful princess. And part of the process is holding this opposite side. Jung refers to it as the tension of the opposites. But it's really required that one can have both of them, sometimes appearing as one and sometimes as the other. The other thing that we might say is that she really does watch out for her opportunities, doesn't she? She does not shy away from the opportunity that's presented to her. She really says, okay, now it's time again. And again has a good sense of timing, but uses a certain assertion, doesn't she? Oh, I want to do this. And she sees how to get where she's going. Anybody have a comment about this one? How does she love? Absolutely. Well, you know, lying is part of the process, isn't it, in a way? I mean, it's like one lies to oneself until you're really ready to fess up and be straight on. Or maybe learns to lie to others. And look at the situation she came from. I mean, she's going to have to. She learned to lie from home, probably, so she could evade things. You know, people are great at lying, aren't they? I mean, I ask people, are you telling me the truth? Yeah, I'm just leaving off the details. You know, I mean, it doesn't make a difference if you omit. You kind of tell the truth. But, you know, I mean, it's a matter of getting deeper into the psyche, and then maybe you don't have to lie so much. But, you know, that's a good thing to bring up. She's not such a sweetie, is she? I don't think one should be so sweet, right? I mean, you have to lie. But the other thing is that she does give a clue here. He says, who are you? She says, I'm a poor child without father or mother. It's the exact same thing that she said when he asked her before. Well, he didn't remember. Or he didn't pick up on him. She gave a clue. He wasn't ready either. You see, it's a readiness on both the male and the female side. He's not yet ready to come out and be united with her, just like she is also not yet ready to unite with him. Goes both ways. Doesn't recognize the dresses. How would he have recognized them? He didn't see them before. How would he have seen them? This is a different king. But my idea of it was that maybe they would all have a similar style to them, and that he wouldn't have recognized that there was a similarity. But that was just my idea about it. Doesn't really say much there about it. He knew who she was. Oh, sure. Right. Right.
She said, I'm a poor child. She said that to hundred
times. Ah, sorry. Thank you. You know, again, that points up how important it is to look at all the details in the fairy tale. And don't project your own ideas or wishes or wants in there, just like it is with the dream. I mean, you can't say
that. But it's interesting that she says she was saying that father, mother, and father, that's not quite true. And the second time she was without mother, that's not quite true. But she wasn't there. She has been psychologically and a man. Mother died. But she still has a father. But he's abandoned her as a daughter by
psychologically. Yes. Psychologically poor.
Yeah, I know that.
She's not really. No, but so she's maybe, what is she doing? Maybe this is a little of her lie. No, she's not saying. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, you know, she's not yet ready to assume that. It's not safe yet. You know, I mean, this again is a story of incest. It is not safe to come out. It takes a very long time to move out from all of that, which really in some ways creates such a protection. Don't say anything. Don't talk. Be silent. It didn't happen. You're not right. You didn't see it. You didn't feel it. There's all kinds of things around that one is not ready to reclaim. You had a comment?
One thing that, I mean, this is a translation.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't, I mean, even though here she's a poor child forsaken, and here she's a poor child without, we really don't know what the original Greek word is.
No, we don't.
And so we're really up putting ourselves in the hands of person who translated and understand fantasies.
That's exactly right. That's very true. You know, supposedly that happened when Freud was translated into English, that it was really a very poor translation, and that Bruno Bettelheim wrote quite a bit on this, or a whole kind of articles or whatever, that really, and Freud really didn't care too much, not realizing how influential America would be in the world of psychology and psychiatry. And the translation is very important, you're right, because a culture carries a certain way of speaking and a certain relatedness and certain connections between people which would not come in the translation, which is also why when you work with people who are from this culture, that culture, another culture, it's very important to know, well, how is that translated in your culture? You know, what is it about you that is different or the same or alike or whatever? No, but you're right there. Anybody else? Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, she's getting closer to the feminine. She's getting closer to herself, right? Yeah, yeah. That's why she's ready to risk more. Once again, this whole idea of her being covered with shame takes a long time to risk. Gradually it comes out. The other thing that is that she lives in a little stable. It's like where the animals live. Stable. A little point of stability. Yes. No, no. No. It's small. Well, but you know, there's something comforting about living in a very small space. One is you don't have to worry about filling it up too much, because you don't have too much to fill it up with, probably. And also, you feel real surrounded. And you've got to be, I mean, if you're going through rebirth, you've got to be, you know, in the womb again and kind of tight, and you can't have too much space around you. So there's something good about that point of stability and smallness of space. And it's the scene of the nativity, right. Right, and you know, we didn't mention about, well, there is the three here, with the three dresses and the three things that she takes, and maybe the three stages of her coming out, which is a masculine number. So inevitably, there's this dealing with the masculine in many different kinds of ways in the fairy tale. Okay, how about if we go on to the next?
Well, the group is upstairs. She fetched the golden spinning wheel and dropped it into soup and it was ready. The king again ate it with great relish. It was as good as before, and when he sent the cook to ask who made it, he was obliged to own that it was as he heard. She was also ordered to pray for the king, but he could get nothing out of her, excepting that she was a poor child in the ending of the golden spinning wheel. At the king's spinning festival, everything happened as before. But the cook said, "I will let you go and see the dancing room this time, bargain first. Then it will leave you are rich. For although the soup is good, the king says it's better than I can make it, there's always something dropped in it which I cannot understand." Rosenberg did not stop to listen. She ran quickly to her little stable, washed up in that stain, and this time dressed herself in a dress that glittered like the stars. When the king came as before to receive her with all, he thought he had never seen such a beautiful woman in his life. While they were dancing, he contrived, without being noticed by the maiden, to slip a gold ring on her finger, and he had given orders that the dancing should continue longer than this time. When it ended, he wanted to hold her hand still, that she pulled it away.
So what do you think about the cook who says, "I believe you are a witch"? What is that? Maybe there is this kind of conscious part which really doesn't understand what's going on. Doesn't understand the symbol. No. It's very concrete. And you know, that's one of the things that makes it sometimes difficult, the whole process. We all have these concrete parts which will not understand what is going on and say and put it in these ways of, oh, this must be witchy, or this can't be understood, or this isn't rational, or it's not logical. And so we all have a little bit of this cook inside of us who's not going to quite understand what's going on unconsciously. Also, she moves very quickly. We haven't mentioned that. She very quickly can change. And here we come back to this whole idea, too, of the persona. It changes very fast, doesn't it? And she can move out and then shift back into the other. So there must be a continuation that's going on and a holding of this one side way of being, a lower side, and kind of a more beautiful or differently beautiful kind of queenly or father's, king's daughter side.
That's
she could shift.
Spinning wheel as part of her life, the threads of her life.
Right.
She will not hold still now. She is not completed, but the thing must continue until she is.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
And often, so part of the, what I've seen, especially where there's been a lot of abuse, is that people can't hold on to things like themselves for very long. And there's the really elegant, and they can be very feminine and very polished, and then the new. Yes, and
it looks like
an
shit.
Hands,
right.
Throwing and screaming and yelling and vanishing, and she can't hold it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. And as well as a person who at one time, again, looks gorgeous, but then can look completely awful. I mean, just go from one side to the other. I mean, we all can kind of do that, you know. We come out of the shower, we look like, ugh. Or whatever. And then we put all of our stuff on and we look okay. But I think there is something about people who've been very damaged with this incest that they can't, because how come they can't hold it? They don't have the self inside. Right. Let me just mention in relation to that, that most Jungian analysts or Jungian psychology doesn't really buy the story of multiple personality disorders. I just kind of put that in with a little bit of, we want to kind of question things, okay? And the reason is that Jung refers to almost all kinds of things as complexes. I mean, the ego is a complex, the shadow is a complex, the persona is, the anima, animus, and so that the multiple personality disorders would be more the kind of splits in the personality, and that there's a central personality running the whole thing. I have heard people speak about multiple personality disorders and then speak to the different aspects of the person. I think it would be more to speak to the primary person who's running the show, because there's someone primary that's running the show. But I think that that's why in Jungian psychology.
You know, however, you know, even if you don't find that diagnosis, however you look at it clinically, just the presence of the person is changing the outward expression of the self. So
right.
The world sees a different face and maybe a different personality, a different way.
Right. Right. Yeah, I think the point is that we all change our faces and we put on our different personas and our different hats, but we do it with consciousness. She is consciously doing it. She's doing it out of choice. This, what you're describing of the person who looks completely wonderful and then a disaster, it's not out of choice from within. It's out of, it just comes. It's like, There's nothing that can make any kind of, again, no choice. It's unconsciously out.
Ego isn't stable. It's not like ego ran too much.
That's exactly right. That's right. But what we might say is, what about her? Where is her ego? It's in transition. She's really got one, you know. I'm certainly more than some of what you described.
I think that's the incest intent and the incest acting out. The trauma levels are different. The shattering of the personality structures are different.
Right.
Jung says in that letter he quoted that when there's been actual incest,
the trauma to the personality is great.
That's right. That's right.
She's more than like, yeah, I'm getting out of here before it happens.
She left before
she's
it.
Older.
Yes.
She's
older, and that's another thing. So the ego has had much more chance to be able to develop.
During the effects of coolers, it doesn't have to be right now.
She has, but that's where she is, in the cobra. Mm-hmm. But, but I think that there are levels of shattering, and that the blow from the cobra incest is great, but I think that there's been quite substantial ongoing
physical
abuse. You know, like first degree burn, second degree burn, third degree burn.
Right.
They're all burns.
Right.
But the severity is markedly different.
Right.
And the survival.
Well, the ability to hold up any tension at all is, I think, it tells you can measure that and you can improve it.
Right.
And then it's kind of a physical abrasion at all. It's very good. It's very good.
Can't hold the tension. No. And but I think we also want to say that the incestuous psychological, physical, there again, different levels of damage, destruction to the personality. Basically what happens is that that potential has a really hard time getting out of the shell. I mean, in any of these levels we're talking about, it has a hard time getting out of the shell. Even if somebody looks like they might be living to their potential, they're really not in some ways. If you ask them, they will tell you, I'm not really living to myself. Even if it's somebody who looks to the outside world like they are living to their full selves, they're not. So, you know, we each know how far we really can go. Not in an inflated kind of way, but I think more from really understanding, yeah, I know how far I could go here, and I know I'm not living it out. So there's always a damage to that development of the personality in some kind of a way.
And you sort of like concentrate to me, the stronger that persona, it can hold up to a certain point quite well for that.
Yeah, I think we might use the word rigid persona.
Mm-hmm.
So when it's rigid and not flexible, it's really making up for something that is not there inside. It's pasted on. Yeah. Okay, who's next to read here?
She ran out of breath from her seat all the steps, for she knew that she had remained longer away than half an hour, and there was not time to take off her dress. So she threw on her fur coat over it, and in her haste she did not make her face black enough nor hide her golden hair properly. Her hands also remained white. However, when she entered the kitchen, the cook was still away, so she prepared the king's soup and dropped into it the golden hook. The king, when he found another trinket in his soup, sent immediately for 1,000 furs. And as she entered the room, he saw the ring on her white finger, which he had placed there. Instantly, he seized her hand and held her fast. But in her struggles to get free, the fur mantle opened and the star glittering dress was plainly seen. The king caught the mantle and tore it off, and as he did so, her golden hair fell over her shoulders, and she stood before him in her full splendor and felt that she could no longer conceal who she was. When she wiped the soot and stains from her face, she was as beautiful to the eyes of the king as any woman upon earth. You shall be my dear bride, said the king, and we will never be parted again, although I know not who you are. Then she told him her past history and all that had happened to her, and he found that she was, as he thought, the king's daughter, and soon after the marriage was celebrated, and they lived happily till their death.
Another happy ending. Yes. Yes. There's a lot. Well, you know, that's what I was referring to last night, in a bit sarcastically, is that it does seem to be that the woman is selected because she's gorgeous. But I also think we have to realize that, or think about, that might be referring to a beauty inward. Yeah, right. And that it really is not just an outside beauty. And that truly, you know, as one is themselves, then they're beautiful. So that the more you know somebody, or the more you see, or the more you're, or the closer you are to them, or to yourself, the beauty really does come out. I think that it refers to the old, also to the old myth of women are selected because they're gorgeous, and if they're not gorgeous, then they are not selected. There's something in that kind of stereotype, which is. Right. 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 So it refers maybe to both. I think again that there is a stereotype that the one. We live in that stereotype.
I mean, the effect of desire.
It does, but it also is something that has caused a lot of pain, I think, for a lot of people, that if you're not the most gorgeous one in the land, do you have any value as a person?
No. Do you have a chance to marry?
Or do you have a chance to marry? Exactly, exactly. And the implication is unless you're not beautiful, you're not going to make it. You're not going to be discovered. You want... Right, right. So there is something that we also are still carrying through our culture and in ourselves, that the beauty is not just a beauty that refers to the soul, but it also is this kind of outer beauty, and if we don't have enough outer stuff, are we going to make it? I think it's being conscious of this that we might be carrying that's very important. And then maybe we can help wise up the culture. Because truly it's there, isn't it? As well as, it isn't only that, I mean, it's that one has to be beautiful, and then there's an additional space that we have in our culture of one is supposed to be young. So that if a girl is 12 years old, she's too old for 17 magazine. Right? You can't be on 17, you can't be a model if you are, you know, if you're 17, you can't be in 17. That's it. You know, you've got to be 11 or something. So, that's one portion of it that we might still carry today. Did anybody have a reaction to, now I've read this before, but it struck me a bit differently, that the king caught the mantle and tore it off? My God. Huh.
I think she is, she wants to be safe.
Uh-huh. His rapaciousness might be all right.
She teased him
enough.
Yeah, and this whole paragraph, I just have this image of this struggle.
Struggle.
I mean, he sees the hand, he grabs it, and he's got it, and she's tussling with him, but then when she's finally in, she still has this little place, which is kind of...
It is, isn't it? You know, I think that the struggle that goes on reflects how much of a struggle it is to be revealed as well as to unite when there has been so much of this incestuousness from the father to the daughter. She has a great deal of trouble uniting, that is inwardly and also outwardly. Very big struggle. Yes? Well, she's, yeah, sure. I mean, she, you know, her unconscious is saying, look it, I'm ready to come out.
Right.
You don't think so.
And he's saying, I think I found you. And he contrives to act on suspicion, and then he discovers her.
Right. Well, you see, he takes some initiative now. He grabs her, or he also puts the ring on her finger. So he figures it out. He does something. He doesn't just wait for her now.
So.
You've got to be quick, don't you? Right.
It's a little bit like Cinderella, too.
instead of the slippers, the
linen. Yeah, that's right.
And the ring fits her perfectly.
That's right. No, it wouldn't have fit one of those fat stepsisters, would it? No. Or the one who might have been too thin, it would have fallen off her finger. So, you're right. But see, again, we have these parallels that go throughout, don't they? In all the fairy tales.
You know, but because he's seeing her same face, or he's seeing her, she has allowed him to see her face as part of her view of himself. And the next sentence says, then she told him her past history and all that had happened to her. Mm-hmm. So she found a partner who would accept her talents because often it's very hard to keep that name.
Right. The other thing that we might say in addition to the shame is that the black might also reflect this kind of sadness, depression, sorrow, difficult work that she's had to do. The other thing is that he wants to take her for a bride, but it doesn't happen until she says everything that happened to her. So she has shared herself, and they have known each other before they unite.
He says, I will take you, although I do not know.
Right.
He will accept her as she is.
As she is.
Whatever her past has
been. Right. But she needs to tell him.
But he will accept, and she knows he will accept the world.
So in other words, this whole aspect of acceptance and
by
another and being open would be the reversal of what had happened at the beginning. She couldn't really be open with her father, could she? Or she tried. She said, I don't want to marry you. He said, forget it. You don't have a choice here. And how open could she have been with, well, we don't know about the mother. She's kind of a different story. But
he also believed that she was his own daughter, so it's a huge risk in his life. But yet, but with folks like that, you don't get those things.
No, you don't. No, you don't.
And then she left it against the she was royal and then against the self.
Yeah, that's the self.
And it really is, and you'll be on the royal wedding in the transfer, mm-hmm. where the inner marriage became queen as opposed to the outer prince. But there is some kind of fear if somebody really knew what happened, they would leave
it.
You know, it would be too awful in a relationship to really tell it all.
Right.
It's hard stuff to
tell. Right, exactly.
But
the telling brings up the trauma again, and in the telling, you are seeing yourself differently than when you keep it inside of yourself. So when someone in analysis tells, they are going to hear it in another way than what they have heard it inside. And there's where I think it's difficult to tell. I mean, we can tell ourselves lots of things inwardly, and then when you say it outwardly, it's got a whole other cast to it. It means a whole other way. And you hear additional information, too, which is the other thing that happens. So it's a nice ending. Anybody have any other comments about this that we should cover here? She got to herself. He also did work too. We've got to admit that. He also did some stuff. And has the father principle been changed? Got to have been. Otherwise, she wouldn't have gotten together with him. So let me ask you, we kind of come back a little bit, we're almost towards the end, but we come back a little bit to this whole question of how do we father ourselves? We've read this whole fairy tale. It gives us some ideas and some clues, but how could we do it?
We provide for ourselves. We take charge and provide for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The result of her actions was to find herself a husband who was appropriate for her, which should have been her father's or her parents. In those times, their
choice. Mm-hmm.
Or at least to help them in that process. And so she wanted to do it herself and figured out ways to do it. In a sense.
In other words, using her creativity, because she was very creative, in order to find her way in life. The other thing that we didn't mention is she went from one land to another. So she went from one psychological principle that was ruling the land to a different kind of psychological principle that was ruling. And also there's another thing of having to do it oneself. I don't think that means I have to do it alone, but in a sense, it does mean that you have to do it alone. I mean, you know, it's like analysis. You do it in conjunction with another, and still you have to do the work. So it's a matter of gaining a strength to be able to do the work, as well as not being done before you're done. She could have been done the first done, right? But then it would have been premature. It's a matter of hanging on through the process, which is another thing that we might father ourselves with. It's kind of hanging on and staying with a certain perseverance to let all of our potential come out. You know, I say this again. I was speaking with someone who is a very competent person and looks very good out in the world and looks like they've accomplished a tremendous amount. Yet to themselves they have not. And this is not just drivenness. This is a true thing. So that if we said, if myself and this person would say, all right, really, you've done enough. You don't have to accomplish anymore or achieve anymore. And we're just having this discussion. And we decided it isn't accomplishment or achievement. It is a certain being space that would reflect truly living all of the personality. It's amorphous words, but it really relates to the emergence of the self. And really sticking with the process long enough to let it come out and not being done prematurely. Yes?
This reminds me of leaving analysis circle when you start feeling better and
yeah.
Life is coming together and things are happening and there's that love. That's really all I want. And then there's this whatever it tells you. Kind of thing, and I think that this they're with you from the beginning, but they're real.
And you have to make the time to let them come out, right? Again, I think it's different than saying, I've got to have all of this raft of accomplishments. It's much more, I've got to live out of my true center and let it come out, no matter what that means. It also means not settling for half-done or half-baked or settling just because, well, it looks pretty good and, you know, the world would approve and I shouldn't want more. Maybe you should want more, you know. Look at what she went after. I mean, she didn't just marry some, you know, she didn't say, okay, I'll marry the cook. Right? She said, I've got to have a king. She had her eyes set on him. I mean, you know, to go from this kind of disaster of the incestuous father with these kind of hooks into her, and then she didn't settle. She went through all of this journey and difficulty to get really what would be appropriate to her. So it's really letting it completely roll out. Living our potential out completely. So we might say fathering might relate somewhere to, in a way, nurturing, the father nurturing the potential that we have inside of us.
Is that because father perceives potential?
He very well might. Mm-hmm.
Well, I have. I want to finish this sentence, but it's not. I need help. That to do a good job, you need to accept the gifts offered by the Father. But where are they coming? Okay, we agree that the dresses were gifts from the Father, right?
What?
Not possessions of the Father.
Right.
So, what would that look like psychologically? What are some of the gifts?
Of the Father. Who has some ideas of the gifts of the Father? We didn't talk about gifts of the Father, did we, so much? Yeah? Do you have an idea?
Sure. A supportive vision. Maybe a supportive vision. Maybe supportive vision. Maybe supportive vision. Maybe supportive vision.
Mm-hmm. Provider part. Support in living. Maintenance. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Intellect.
The father's been in the world in a high profession, the mother's been doctor's wife.
Yes.
A supportive wife.
Right.
Raising the children in that prestige and doing the
right. Right. Intellect. Mm-hmm. Yes. And being pleased about it. Mm-hmm. I must say, if you read Jung, he oftentimes refers to the intellect of the woman in a bit of a dim way. And it's a question. Why should the logos only belong to the male, and can't there be a female kind of logos? And if a woman is living out of her mind, is she really not, if she really just animus possessed? I just must bring that up as a question. Because there's certain, doesn't mean one is animus possessed. Perhaps one has an animus, but not possessed by it. So. Yes, but you see, I must say also that one wants to watch that, because it is around anyway, that if you have an animus and you happen to be in relationship to it, maybe it won't be so nicely liked. So one wants to be, again, aware. Maybe there's a certain awareness that relates to the father too, because we did say that the father has to do with this kind of out in the world place also, or getting us out in the world, or allowing us to be out in the world. Could be the gift of the fathers also. Absolutely. Right.
These things that we have from our parents, from both sides, whether they're boys or girls, from our mothers or our fathers, even whether it's athletics or music, I mean, yeah, both fathers and musicians, the father takes up music, but isn't able to do it without doing it in an almost good way. I think it's nice to refer to my friend who's discussing the family's baby. You know, she has to not do certain things because she's too almost driven.
Right.
To rediscover the
That's
one
it.
Own way of relating to that gift of the Father.
Right.
Doing it in the mother's style.
Exactly. And that's doing it in your own style. And that she did that here, didn't she? That's the making of the soup. Doing it in her own style and letting it come out that way. So those are some, any other gifts from the Father that we might think about? Anything else that comes up?
I think the higher education maybe doesn't have to.
Mm-hmm.
How does it really help nurture the new learning child in a way? And I think to get to the university,
it's part of it.
Changing now, I think that's really good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Of seeing it as separate and
yes.
Yes.
Yes, that's right. I think there's something in there, what you're saying too, about seeing the gift of the daughter as separate.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing what she's got as separate, allowing the separation there. Takes a pretty aware father, but that's, we're saying the gifts of the father might be there in that kind of separation. You can have it, you can do it, kind of encouragement space. Mm-hmm.
I think there's a little bit of detachment in fathers have, which is different from mothers, because mothers usually have the little kids underfoot all the time, so every risk, every step that the one-year-old is on, it looks like they're going to fall backwards, is kind of a gas. And fathers have a little bit more attachment about loves and bruises in the outside world. And so to have that in oneself, a little bit of detachment,
mm-hmm.
about risk-taking and being, I think also to extension of what you were saying,
mm-hmm.
that's
another gift. Yeah.
I have to watch it in myself to not get so
enmeshed. About every bump.
Another tendency.
Mm-hmm.
And detachment, a little bit of that.
Mm-hmm. You know, they've made studies of how men deal with babies and how women deal with babies. And the men are much more, you know, they'll toss them up in the air. How many women do you see tossing the kids up in the air? But it's the men that do. As if saying, you know, go for it. Detach. That's all right. You know, fly a little. And it's the moms who actually hold the babies closer. And dads, when they hold babies, they tend to, you know, hold them more like a football. Probably not in all instances, but whatever studies have been done have kind of said that there's kind of a general way. And actually, boys are usually held by mothers a bit farther away than they hold the daughters. So there's something very early that begins about this detachment, or an ability to detach, or not get so involved so that you can live your life. There's certain healthiness to the detachment. So we have a few gifts from the Father, huh? Okay. Yes?
One that we have mentioned with those sexuality things that we get
back. Good point, yes. It's very important, right. And it's important that it's perceived correctly and done in a correct kind of way. Now, this fairy tale is an example of an incorrect way, right, which would not allow her to have her sexuality with anybody, but only with Father. But when it's done in a correct way and he appreciates her as a female, then he's transferred onto her a lot of positive energy and lets her free to be an adult in the world. So there's a certain freedom with the Father, too, then. Mm-hmm.
And if that initiation is not taken up to the Father and we discuss the male...
If the initiation to sexuality is not done well from the Father to the daughter...
Be careful, this guy is going to be happy, you know, he's a pretty attractive woman.
If you mean if he says that... If he never says that, well, let's say if he never says that, or if he does say that, then there are messages that are sent. One is, you're pretty attractive, watch out for those other guys, means, don't you dare move out of here. And the other is, you're pretty attractive, the other part of that might be, I'm really seeing that in you. If it's done nicely, it can help her move out in the world. It could also create a lot of fear of the male in her. If nothing is ever said about her attractiveness and her sexuality, what does she learn? Can you imagine? Nothing. That's the disaster of it. It can be nothing. It could be like, I've never been seen by him. Maybe I'm not sexual. Maybe I am not a person. Maybe I don't exist somehow. There's something awful about getting no feedback at all. It's absolutely appalling because then you're up against a complete blank wall. So, I would like to read one more thing just to close today because I think we're about at the time that we said we would go to. Unless anybody has any other comments that you would like to make. Okay. This is from Rilke. As once the winged energy of delight carried you over childhood's dark abysses, now beyond your own life build the great arch of unimagined bridges. Wonders happen if we can succeed in passing through the harshest danger, but only in a bright and purely granted achievement can we realize the wonder. To work with things in the indescribable relationship is not too hard for us. The pattern grows more intricate and subtle, and being swept along is not enough. Take your practice powers and stretch them out until they span the chasm between two contradictions, for the God wants to know himself in you. That is from, now this one I have the answer, Uncollected Poems. The name of it is As Once the Winged Energy of Delight. And in that one, it's got the German on one side of the page and the English on the other. It's page 261. So, I want to thank you for your attention and comments, which were all wonderful. And have a good day.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.